Welcome back, everyone, to another Unusual Whales panel, this time on quantum computing, investment, innovation, and a little policy here in 2025. This panel is sponsored by Defiance ETFs and their quantum ETF, ticker QTUM. As quantum computing technology advances, there sits the possibilities for development and hardware scalability, national security implications, and of course, possible investment opportunities, all of which we'll touch on today. Now, right here at the top, a little bit of a disclaimer. As we will be discussing individual investments, it's important to note that each of your individual circumstances are different. So you need to make sure that you read about each investment carefully so that it fits your risk and return profile. Also note that nothing in this space should be directly construed as actionable financial advice or a solicitation to buy and sell any security or derivatives. Always conduct your own research or discuss with your licensed financial advisor before making or taking any given investment. Now, with all of that said and out of the way, I'm going to run through our panelists that will be sharing their expertise with us today. Starting off with Sylvia Jablonski. She is the CEO and CIO of today's sponsor, Defiance ETFs, who manages that quantum ETF, ticker QTUM. She's a pioneer in the ETF space and formerly acted as the managing director at Direction and contributed heavily to ETF education and strategy across the globe. Really excited to have your expertise with us today, and thank you again for sponsoring the panel today, Sylvia.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so glad to be here with everybody today.
Next, we have Pierre-Luc Daher-Demer. Pierre-Luc is the founder of Pauly Group, a company that's been implementing post-quantum cryptography and blockchain technology since 2021. He earned his PhD in theoretical physics from the University of Saarland in Germany in 2016, and he was formerly a quantum algorithm researcher at Xanadu and Zapata Computing. His expertise lies developing quantum-resistant communication methods, and I'm really excited to have his takes here today. Welcome, Pierre-Luc.
Thank you for having me. So it's a pleasure to be on the channel with the other speakers.
And a pleasure to have you. Next, we have Patrick Coles, the chief scientist at Normal Computing, where he specializes in thermodynamic artificial intelligence. Previously a quantum physicist at Los Alamos National Laboratory and served as the lead principal investigator for LANL's new-term quantum computing group. He also played a pivotal role in education and research development by organizing LANL's quantum computing summer school. Welcome, Patrick.
Great. Thank you for having me. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Thanks.
And as Whale mentioned, we may be having another speaker join us a little later on. Hopefully she'll be able to join us today. But for now, let's go ahead and get started. Now, first to the panelists, I really like to keep my panels as wide open as possible, especially on a topic like this where I'm personally not super well versed. So as we go along, please feel free to chime in if you've ever got anything to add to what one of the other panelists has said. The only request that I have is we leave a little breath of fresh air between when one speaker ends and another starts, just to keep out any feedback or background noise or echoes. Now, I'm going to start us off by jumping right into the thick of it here. A number of tech companies have seemingly been leading the charge in this field of quantum computing. Just this month, for example, Microsoft unveiled its Majorana 1 chip, claiming it could pave the way for quantum systems with up to a million qubits on a single processor. In addition to that, there's Google's Sycamore processor, which has reportedly doubled its computational advantage over classical computers. Now, to start us off right at the top here, Sylvia, could you give us a little bit of a brief overview of what some of this means to the average person and what folks at Quantum ETF are watching for, you know, for by way of the development of quantum computing and how it's going to be implemented?
Yeah, sure. So it's certainly a very exciting time for quantum computing. And, you know, maybe I'll talk about it a little bit high level and how we see things. I think you have some awesome panelists here who are like really in the woods, probably on the was with lots of expertise on the technology side of things. But You know, we Defiance launched this quantum ETF, you know, which holds 70 plus stocks that represent the quantum industry in 2018. It was kind of the flagship of what started our ETF company. And, you know, back then we were sitting in a room thinking about what is the future. We were thinking about a couple of things, right? We thought that there would be this transition of wealth and, you know, trillions of dollars of wealth would fall to millennial, Gen Z, beyond. And, you know, what those groups cared about most was, you know, the future, innovation, disruption, you know, the future of innovative technology. And so we started looking through sector ETFs and thinking about, well, tech is, you know, tech is maybe Qs or some other type of ETF, but what will it look like in the future? And at that time, we talked a lot about 2018, like it's going to be AI, machine learning, supercomputing, quantum computing, that, you know, that's what it'll be, 5G, perhaps things like this. And so, you know, we launched these ETFs for the kind of like hope and thought that these would be, you know, major themes and trends that would come within the next couple of years. And, you know, it really wasn't until the ChatGPT moment of Microsoft where, like, quantum was a great ETF, right? It's been out for a long time. It's had annual double-digit performance. It's done really great, but nobody kind of knew about it or paid attention to it. And, you know, once ChatGPT came out, Microsoft had, you know, that ChatGPT moment, I think it got on the map from the machine learning AI aspect of it. And then, you know, the Willow moment was really when this ETF propelled, and we went from being, you know, having $100 million, which took years and years and years to gather, to $1 billion, which took, you know, less than a year to gather. And I think, you know, the idea here is that the idea behind the ETF is basically that quantum computing and machine learning are transformative technologies. They're going to reshape the future. You know, quantum computing has moved from kind of a thesis and a theoretical possibility to a demonstrated reality to some degree. And it's becoming, you know, kind of more and more demonstrated as these different announcements are coming out, you know, Amazon being the most recent one today. And the idea was that, you know, we liked the idea that there were these recent breakthroughs that show quantum computers can solve problems in minutes that would take, you know, computers millions of years to do. It indicated this transformative potential that the technology has for machine learning, for AI, for applications. You know, we thought that this would be super interesting. And then, like, if you just kind of look at the stats on this, right, the quantum industry is estimated to grow at a 35% CAGR into 2032. The market is poised to get to multi-billions, and, you know, the government is interested in it. Quantum is already used in drug discovery, cryptography, material science. And if you think about, like, what this technology is capable of doing, if it all comes to fruition, we just think it's going to be one of the most massive, you know, shifts and opportunities, both in, you know, technology and for investors for the next decade or so.
Well said. Thank you, Sylvia. A lot to unpack there. And we're probably going to touch on most of the topics Sylvia brought up and a few others. Now, larger established companies like Google and IBM tend to focus on superconducting qubits, while startups like PsiQuantum and Xanadu are betting on photonic quantum computing. Now, Patrick, these are two words that I myself don't have a huge grasp on. So briefly for the listeners, what are these two different approaches, and which hardware architecture appears the most promising for commercial adoption?
Yeah, thanks for the question. So superconducting qubits are electrical circuits. It's all electrical based. It is low temperature, which means that it has to be run typically inside of a dilution refrigerator, which is a very large refrigerator to cool down to millikelvin temperatures. So in that sense, it's not going to replace your laptop, of course. But in any case, superconducting qubits rely on this circuit architecture that's called a Josephson junction. And those were arguably the first to be publicly released on the cloud. IBM is another big player there. And they released the first cloud-based superconducting qubit quantum computer in 2016. That started the so-called NISQ era, noisy intermediate scale quantum era. It is the basis for Google's Sycamore chip, which came out in 2019, as well as their Willow chip, which came out just last year. Now, the photonic chips PsiQuantum and Xanadu, they are taking different approaches to photonic quantum computing, but I think PsiQuantum's selling point is they say that they're going to do this all in silicon, right? So because, of course, you want to be able to try to leverage silicon CMOS fabrication. So I think that's their selling point, is that they want to build, you know, photonic chips in silicon. Xanadu is taking a slightly different approach, but and actually Pierre could probably comment more on that, because I think he has some connections there. Do you want to say anything about photonic, Pierre?
Yeah, so the approach of photonic, like the base carrier of quantum information in photonic, is like photons. So photons are useful like carrier of quantum information because they move at the speed of light. But since they move at the speed of light, they're not so much great quantum memory. So a lot of the challenge of like a photonic architecture will is still to establish good quantum memories purely from the photonic approach. What I mostly see in the future, so is the integration of various technologies. So like the very like to get to like the commercial quantum computers like that changes industries, we will need very large quantum computers, and those machines will not the first big machine will not fit in a small box. Like it will likely be like several tens, if not hundreds, of like smaller quantum computers all connected together. And there, like the photonic glue makes sense, because like how we will transfer information between those machines, like the photons are kind of like the natural carrier there. So like we're still in the era where companies are putting almost all their eggs in the same basket. Like either they're going all in on superconductors, all in on photonic, all in on neutral atoms. But what I expect to see, and like we're starting to see it with IonQ. IonQ is starting to invest in quantum networks, so like the glue between the quantum computers. But that's kind of what I expect to see, like an integration of the different technologies with their different strengths. So like superconductors are good for memory, neutral atoms can be good for memory, photonics are good for like carrying information. So most likely in the next decade, like we will see a much stronger integration of all the different technologies, like toward large scale quantum computers.
Thank you, Pierre and Patrick. So I want to touch a little bit on that topic of scalability as well. Dr. Sebrakai of Purdue University warns that quantum solutions do need to be scalable to provide real-world value. Now, how can or how are businesses determining when quantum computing will genuinely outperform classical optimization methods, and what's being done to kind of increase that scalability for commercial use?
Yeah. So I think it's important to emphasize that quantum computing, in my opinion, is really an application-specific paradigm. It was introduced in particular to simulate other quantum systems by Richard Feynman and others. So in that sense, the early applications of quantum computing will be in material science, simulating other quantum materials. And so it's actually not good to have too much media hype on some of these classical-based applications like AI and machine learning. AI, in fact, John Preskill has been quoted in saying that the impact of quantum computing on machine learning in terms of speedups has not yet been proven. So, you know, it's important to understand that quantum computers ultimately are application-specific chips that are really good at certain things, but are not universal in the sense that they're not necessarily going to speed up every application. And of course, it's like tiered in the sense that the time scale for accelerating material science is much shorter than the time scale for accelerating things like optimization and machine learning. So I just wanted to get that point out there. And that's one of the reasons why I left the field of quantum computing. I now work on physics-based computing that's classical, called thermodynamic computing. So, you know, obviously I'm not trying to bias the panel in any particular way, of course, and other people can provide different perspectives. But I think it's important for people to understand what quantum computers are actually good for and what they're not meant for. I don't know. Pierre, feel free to comment on that further if you want.
Yeah, I'll take it from like the scalability. So like the scalability is important. We'll see, because like the, well, I guess Patrick and I were from that era, like the era where we had like small quantum computers which are very noisy. And say 10 years ago, it was very difficult to simulate them. So like many approaches were try to use those machines for like the small machines for quantum, for machine learning, for artificial intelligence. But people ran into the wall essentially of those systems being impossible to train. Like the dimensionality is way too large, and it makes the training almost impossible. So like at the current stage, like Patrick is right that for artificial intelligence application, like there's, we kind of see there should be something, but like there has been no strong indication that it will actually work. So like we're still missing algorithm breakthrough on the side of machine learning. But he's right that like those machines are for specialized applications. So like the simulation of like new molecule, new drugs, new material, like the breaking cryptography. A lot of those problems, they're in some sense they're problems that look like very high dimensional Rubik cubes. So like if you have the 1 million dimensional Rubik cube, that's kind of the type of problems like that quantum computers are very good at solving. But we don't have a way to cast machine learning problem in this framework. And like for the scalability, like the use of like those applications are important, but like with the small machine it doesn't work. We really need quantum computers with hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of components, of qubits, of units, to be able to tackle those problems beyond what we can do with supercomputers. So But those applications are important. So like at labs at Los Alamos or at Oak Ridge, like large supercomputers are trying to attack those problems, and they are failing, say, at designing new high temperature superconductors or new drugs because of the computational limits. So like quantum computers large enough will be able to replace those machines and go like far beyond what could be done, even if we had like classical computers the size of a city or an entire country. So there is to be a sharp advantage when we scale, but the applications are still very limited to like those that either involve quantum mechanics or breaking cryptography.
Yeah, so I think there's some great points made there. Sorry, I got cut off. Useful quantum computers are 30 years away, right? That's really when a lot of the questions came up to us around, you know, how viable is this, right? And what we just heard is that it has to be, you know, sort of scalable to become applicable and more efficient. But there are things, you know, in terms of what we've researched around like the investment perspective as to, you know, why it could be interesting to still research these companies and invest in them, regardless of like how far away that is and how far away really is it, right? And so, you know, companies like IBM, Google, IonQ, they've made significant strides in quantum error correction, scaling, you know, qubit numbers and improving coherence times. We heard the CEO, you know, when the Jensen Huang thing came out, of D-Wave come out and say that, you know, they're already working on quantum computing to some degree, right? They're doing annealing and have these gate-based models, and that doesn't really reflect the current state of what they do. That comment anyway doesn't, which is active quantum computing, right? And so we also, from what we read and hear and learn, and, you know, it's great to have people who are actually working with this day-to-day to shed light on this, but we also hear and learn from the CEOs of the different quantum companies that quantum computing is progressing actually at exponential paces. So, you know, IBM is aiming to deliver a 100,000 qubit system by 2033. And if that happens, right, then, you know, that at least bodes well for commercialization sooner than, you know, at least the 15, 30 year from now number. And yeah, I mean, our sense is that quantum computing is already being applied to these niche problems, whether it's material science or financial modeling, albeit, you know, in hybrid quantum classical-like systems. Companies like D-Wave have operational quantum annealing machines solving real-world optimization problems today. We see the amount of like venture capitalist money going into this, corporate R&D, government grants, which feels like, you know, practical problems and applications could be solved much sooner. And then, you know, again, it's also just, you know, feedback from the CEOs that are working on this stuff, right? So while you have Jensen Huang on one side, you have IBM and Google, you know, talking about quantum making significant strides in the next 3 to 5 years. And I think it's really hard to say, you know, if you're not in it today, you're too late, or if you're in it, you know, or if you're in it today, you're way too early. I think that these technology always moves much faster than we think it will. And, you know, optimization and monetization of these types of technologies definitely happen much faster than we expect them to, in some cases, at least. And so, yeah, I mean, that's really our goal, is just to like make sure we're capturing all the players in the space before, you know, before it does become this, you know, before IonQ is the NVIDIA of quantum computing.
Thank you, Sylvia. Pierre-Luc, I saw your hand there. Did you have something to comment there as well?
Yeah, maybe a few comments on Jensen's like 30 years. So like that 30 years was probably an exaggeration, but like as we say, so on a 5-10 year horizon, we will see applications, as Sylvia is mentioning, like toward like say niche application like materials, drug discovery, even take crypto analysis of cryptocurrencies. And these applications, if like the value is captured correctly, like they can be game changing for many industries. But then like the broadly useful benchmark of like, will there be a quantum computer in 10 years in everyone's home, like doing their running their ChatGPT? Probably not, or at least like no one sees a path like in this direction. So my guess is like the my comment is mostly about like what type of value a quantum computer unlock. And the real question on like the companies building those machines is like, will they be able to like capture the value unlocked by the machines? So like if they build like a large quantum computer that can solve say 1,000 problems a year, will they be able to capitalize say on the new on the IP, on the new drugs, on the new materials, which require them to build entire verticals from the results that derive from quantum computers? So like broadly applicable, like it will be game changing. It can be game changing in the 2030s. The notion of broadly useful, like if you don't count quantum computers being people's home, I think they can be broadly useful like in the next decade.
Yeah, just to add on to that, if it's okay to really quickly comment, like I think you don't have to actually mention AI and quantum in the same sentence. I mean, the AI revolution is happening literally right now as we speak. I mean, you can use ChatGPT to build your own business on the weekend right now with the chatbot. So, I mean, in that sense, I'm worried that quantum is literally going to miss the entire AI revolution. If you're saying quantum is ready 10 years from now, the AI revolution is happening right now. And so, you need a computing platform that's going to be ready within the next 2 to 3 years if you want to hit the AI revolution. And I think quantum is going to miss that. That's my opinion.
The current wave, I agree.
Thank you all. So Risha, thank you for joining us here. I'm going to punt this next one to you. Some industry leaders believe quantum hybrid computing, which integrates quantum and classical computing, will be the first commercially viable use case. Does the hybrid model offer a realistic bridge toward full-scale quantum computing, or is it more of a temporary workaround, in your opinion?
Yeah, thank you for the question. I I worked in these kinds of optimizations where the transition happens from classical and quantum phase transitions, and basically like what are the advantages. And it's definitely, I would look at it as a bridge. It's a compromise for sure. But if we look at realizing the full power of quantum computer, which is extremely volatile with the respect of the decoherence that we are observing in the state of the chips, I would be betting on these kinds of like compromises that we have to make until we can actually harness the full power of quantum computing.
Thank you, Risha. Does anybody have anything to add to that point about quantum hybrid computing?
The way people defined it, especially in the recent years, is often like some kind of loop where you have like a small quantum processor like doing some part of the optimization and then like iterating with the classical processor. I think it's less of an interesting paradigm than it looks like. So in some sense, even very, very, very large quantum computers, like when they come to factoring, like there is some part of the problem which is solved on a classical computer, even if the classical computer is technically like a calculator. And also in reality, like even to Patrick's point, like the very large quantum computers, like they will be operated, like the error correction, which is necessary to reduce the decoherence, it will be operated not only by classical processors, but very likely with the next generation AI chips, like which are going to be completely classical. Because the error correction process itself is extremely compute intensive. And so far, the best results have been using classical machine learning to reduce the error, to reduce the errors. So the most likely very large, motor vehicle helps like rocket launch, like in some sense, yes, they're part of the logistics, but the main workload will be executed by the quantum machines themselves, with the classical machines like assisting in mostly in the error correction. And most likely near term, like classical AI will be used to improve like the algorithms, the error correction, and maybe even the design of quantum computers. So it's more going to be on the assist, I think, than the model of hybrid quantum classical, say, algorithms that we saw in the recent years. Maybe Patrick has a bit more comments on that.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I mean, Pierre's pointing out that actually AI can dramatically help quantum, right? Yes, that's very clear. And the question is, does the reverse hold true? And I'm sort of arguing like that it might not hold true, right? So, but I think that, you know, when I really think about who really is going to benefit the fastest from quantum computing, I think it's going to be the DOE National Labs. Because as Pierre was saying, they're doing these HPC high performance simulations right now, of complex quantum materials. So that's where I see the first real world applications of quantum coming in, as at the DOE National Labs. And that's where I feel like the quantum, you know, people should be marketing towards. I don't see the broader applications at least not in the short term, right? I can maybe in the long term, but yeah, that's
just an analysis. Crypto analysis also, it's roughly the same number of resources, it turns out.
Sorry, what did you say, Pierre?
Crypto analysis. Crypto analysis is comparable in resources to...
No, I think what you're doing is great. I mean, because Pierre is focusing on the post-quantum stuff, which is really useful and something we're going to have to do anyway. So I commend you, Pierre, on what you're doing. Yeah.
Lily, I saw you unmuted. Did you have comments there as well before I move on?
Yeah, I'd just love to throw a question to these guys too, because, you know, one of the ways that we look at it at Defiance is we, you know, we've always talked about how quantum can help AI, right? Which is a little bit different, I guess, from what we're talking about here. And our thought was that there would be potential opportunity for quantum computing's, you know, speed basically to process more data, you know, having more accurate models, solving optimization problems, performing simulations, recognizing patterns that can't be detected with like traditional equipment and things like this. And I'm just curious if just in your, you know, day-to-day work, you have opinions on that or, you know, don't think that that's necessarily a huge, I guess, add to AI.
I can go. It's something a lot of people kind of like gleam quantum for AI, but no one has cracked it like in a significant fashion. So like if you think about it, like the name of the Google group is the Quantum AI group. So like something people have been thinking about for some time. But again, like the way like quantum algorithm, they really look like say a 1 million dimension Rubik cube. So like, is there a way we can use, like we can solve some machine learning problem, like we can cast some machine problem as super large Rubik cube? We haven't figured that out yet. So like, maybe.
This is also one of my areas. So when you look at machine learning or artificial intelligence algorithms, it's all differential optimizations and differential gradients, right? So there is obviously some transitions, some phase transitions that happen, and in quantum computing that are particularly beneficial and really, really optimized for energy levels as well. For which actually match these algorithms. And some of these inferences, I think there's a company I forgot the name of the chips that they are like specifically harnessing this power of optimization and bridging that to machine learning. And when we look at that, what was the other question? Sorry, in regards to? It was if AI, if what are basically the correlations between quantum computing and AI and like how they will like actually cross benefit each other, right? So I actually think even though it's not going to be like the full power of quantum computing that we usually think would harness, but there are certain obvious optimizations that are going to be beneficial to AI in the meantime. And well, as we look at the current model architectures and the current problems in AI, it's a lot of ways that can be, if you want the scaling to actually prevail, it can be completely solved. And just a lot of energy that we are wasting on data centers can be actually reduced. So yeah, that's one of the things that I would be excited about.
Yeah, maybe I can just add that I think we could actually broaden to next gen compute, because you could basically ask like, are GPUs the final answer to AI, right? Or is there something more to be said for AI beyond GPUs? And there's this whole area of next gen computing, which includes quantum, right? But also includes things like neuromorphic computing, thermodynamic computing, and various digital computings like in-memory computing. And you know, and I think there's a lot of active work going on in next-gen computing, even beyond quantum. Obviously, Intel has their neuromorphic chip, and you know, there's you know what I'm working on, which is thermodynamic computing. But in any case, there are legitimate crises that we have to address in AI, like the AI energy crisis. Like AI is consuming huge amounts of energy right now, right? And so I think like it's reasonable to say, hey, let's try to solve this AI energy crisis with next-gen computing. And, you know, quantum may be part of that answer, but I think there's other next-gen computing paradigms as well that could be part of that as well.
Yeah, completely agree.
So with all of these concepts in mind, and as was mentioned by numerous panelists so far, many industries such as finance, pharmaceuticals, logistics, even energy, for example, are exploring these concepts of quantum computing's potential. But real world use, they kind of remain in their early stages, and widespread adoption could possibly take years. Gartner's 2024 hype cycle, for instance, suggests that enterprise-ready quantum applications are still at least a decade away. So, Sylvia, to kind of go back to something you were saying about the timeliness of investment, from an investor's point of view, is right now too early to be deeply exploring investment opportunities for something many say may take over a decade to realize its potential?
Yeah, I think... you know, that's always debatable, right? It's always good to get into Bitcoin when it was a couple hundred bucks, right? And it took a really long time to kind of just take off and whatnot. And I think, you know, AI came more quickly than we thought it would, although it was always there. You know, there are kind of two things. One is, you know, the experts like Patrick and Misha and Pierre-Luc that do this and understand this. And then there's the market and kind of like the hype around themes and things like that. And a lot of times that hype, or when something becomes popular, moves a stock before something actually happens, right? In that particular theme, in terms of like R&D and just, you know, the technology coming to fruition. So there's two things. And the way that, like, when we built this quantum ETF, right, we had that in mind. And so, like, the way that we thought about it was, let's put all of these companies, like, to answer your question, that like D-Wave and, you know, IonQ, Rigetti, quantum computing, some of these, you know, arguably smaller companies, like, let's put them in there, right? Because they're the future of this, they're focused on this, and they could be companies that, you know, really, really make innovations and bring them to fruition, and investors benefit from that. But when we thought about this, like, to your question, for that reason, we also put in companies like Google and, you know, Honeywell, IBM, the larger companies, just to name a few, because while they are relevant to quantum, you know, they're doing a lot of R&D and investing in quantum, they also are quality companies that have strong balance sheets, that are involved in other things like machine learning and AI and things like this. And so I guess it's somewhat promotional too, because I'm talking about my ETF, but on the day that Jensen Huang came out with those comments, right, some of these companies like the Rigettis, the IonQs and whatnot that had been up, you know, triple digits last year, right? They fell like 30-40% out of the sky around those comments. But then if you look at the ETF, it was only down a couple percentage points because it had that ballast of, you know, kind of the large cap companies that do R&D and will influence the space, but it buffered, you know, kind of the pullback. So I think the answer is, yes, you want to invest in these new themes and innovations when it feels too early, but you want to do it in a smart way. Like, I wouldn't put all of my eggs in kind of one basket or one particular stock or technology here, because, you know, with new technologies and innovation in the future, I think you want a balanced portfolio, right? You want exposure to all of the potential players and winners, but you want some kind of built-in hedge if that doesn't come to fruition. And then, you know, also we like the idea of the potential future M&A activity. And it's so interesting because when I keep bringing up this NVIDIA day of the, you know, this thing is 30 years away, and my phone was ringing off the hook, like, uh-oh, you know, maybe that's a company that ends up buying one of these smaller companies. So anyway, yeah, I mean, I'm kind of overdoing it here, but I do think that it's good to have exposure to a balanced, diversified basket.
And I think that's a pretty smart way of looking at it as well. I mean, safe investing, educated investing, pretty important, especially in the case of retail. Yeah, I saw you unmuted there as well. Did you have something to add to Sylvia's comments?
Yeah, like just small comments. Like, is it early? Yes. Is it so early? Is it too early? Probably not. Like, are there like future winners in the market right now, like in 10 years, like who will be winners in 10 years? Very probably. Have we seen everything, or like the market can still be ripe for disruption? But like, we're already seeing a bit of like maturity building in the market. So like, we're seeing small amount of like fragmentation, specialization of companies with along like different aspects of the problems of building the machines. So yeah, like it's not easy. There's still a lot of volatility, like when say the NVIDIA CEO makes comments. But we may have passed the phase of being too early. I think like the current generations in the market will likely be among some of the winners like in about 10 years.
Yes, I agree. Like if you look at history and if you see AlexNet, it was a 2011, which Google acquired it immediately. And if you look at the first few GPT breakthroughs, it was around 21 and 22, then that actually started rolling it. So I think quantum computing will like follow the similar trends, and which will be the winners, that would be decided in the next 4 or 5 years, I believe. And that's what people should keep an eye out on.
Well said. Yeah. Oh, go ahead, Patrick.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that it's interesting to think about timescales and what timescales are ultimately important to us as humans, right? So the timescales that people are talking about typically with quantum computing are like a decade away. Is that the important timescale for us? Or should we be thinking more on like 2 to 3 years? Because like I said, for example, the O3 model with OpenAI can do is truly like mind-blowing. Like they're solving frontier math problems and they're achieving like these AGI benchmarks. And so I think it's worth noting that like, you know, how we think about time scales really matter. You know, it may be that things totally change in the next decade about what our priorities are and what's important. That, you know, I personally feel that we should be focusing on the 2 to 3 year time scale in terms of technology. And on that time scale, it's still looking to me that AI is the king. So that's just what I want to say.
So one more thing I wanted to touch on here before we get to final panelist comments for Sylvia is you brought up some mergers that are kind of on the horizon. And one that I stumbled upon was Horizon Quantum Computing, which is a startup focused specifically on quantum software, announcing their plans earlier this month to go public via a $500 million merger. Now, unlike hardware companies like IBM and Google, software firms don't tend to need to build their own quantum processors themselves. And so kind of a two-parter here. Do you think, from your point of view at Quantum ETFs, think that the software side of quantum computing might offer a faster path to profitability for investors? What's quantum kind of focused on in this space?
Yeah, I don't know that I could, you know, really answer that question in terms of which it offers kind of the, you know, the more lucrative or near-term opportunity. But I guess what I meant about the M&A comment is that a lot of times when you have, you know, disruptive technologies and innovation, just from the investor standpoint, right, you tend to benefit from the M&A and some of these companies. And I think like one of the most prominent mergers in quantum computing was a combination of Honeywell Quantum and Cambridge Quantum Computing, right? Basically merging quantum hardware development with advanced quantum software capabilities. And, you know, that was something that, again, just speaking like from the investor perspective, that was something that the market really liked and thought was moving the field forward. And I think just on a general level, when you have, again, a portfolio of stock that are, you know, kind of the biggest large cap multi-trillion dollar companies and quantum computing startups, you know, there's just potential there, right? If some of those M&A activities happen, they often do because those smaller companies and higher interest rate environments run out of cash and things like that. So
does anyone have anything to add on that, specifically on the topic of quantum computing software versus hardware?
I can say a few words there. Software is a more risky business in the sense that like the protection of the software and like making money out of the software can be tricky. But also like for the sense that the machines that will run it profitably are not built yet. So the protecting the software and like creating the patents for the machine that don't exist yet is still fairly a long shot. But like with the software piece, I think, which is making more of an impact, like on the very near term, are say people building like the decoders, or like some parts of the stack related to the machines, say optimal control, or like the like related to the operation of the hardware piece, rather than the very long term, the very long term, like the 10-year application. So, but like some large companies, they can afford to build like better algorithms, say Google, IBM, but even that I do like as interesting, like for current application papers. But what's happening also is that like those algorithms keep getting better with years. So like, is the money? It's still very much academic. So is the money, the private money invested now, really gonna yield huge return, like on the software side for applications in 10 years? It's an extremely risky bet. So some people are making it, but it's not easy. On the side of M&As, it can make sense for companies building like the full-scale quantum computers to acquire software expertise, mostly on the side of applications. So like the people build, the most acquiring the people more than the long-term application and the value of the long-term application, because the people trained into building quantum applications are very, very few apart. So maybe Patrick has come.
Oh, sorry. What's the topic?
Quantum software.
Quantum software.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting about building tools. I mean, interestingly, even though NVIDIA predicted this 30-year horizon, they still are building tools for the quantum community, in the sense that, you know, like you can always sell, you know, tools to the gold digger during the gold rush, right? So. So I know that they're developing a lot of classical simulation tools. Like, in my opinion, one of the best areas for quantum research is just developing classical simulation tools for quantum systems. But and I think NVIDIA is doing that. I personally don't work on the quantum software side. I know, like, Zapata was a company that did work on that, but then they jumped to AI. So I don't know how promising that area is, frankly.
Yeah. My guess is that in 10 years, it's going to be AI actually programming the quantum computers. Like, it's a, yeah, I don't see all of it. Yeah.
Thank you both. Risha, did you have anything to add to Pierre-Luc and Patrick's comments there on quantum computing software versus hardware?
Yeah, Pierre brought up something really interesting that NVIDIA does have a lot of libraries and like the classical simulations of quantum systems. But I would say right now it's extremely indeterminate what like the software for quantum computers would look like. So I think the best bet would be to make the hardware feasible. That's where the real market would emerge for that.
Thank you, Risha. So what I want to do here, Sylvia, is I want to know a little bit more about what quantum ETFs looking at in this space, kind of how things are being positioned. And as well, at the end here, if you don't mind, could you plug a little bit more information on where people can find out more about the quantum ETF? And how investors can kind of keep an eye on how things are being run over there.
Yeah, sure. So the ticker on the fund is QTUM. And what this is it's an ETF that attracts an index, attracts the Blue Star Machine Learning and Quantum Computing Index. And it's basically tracking the performance of companies involved in industries related to quantum computing or machine learning. So it includes names that are names in quantum computing, including like superconducting materials, applications for algorithms built for quantum computers, equipment and materials, specifically around the manufacturing of quantum computers, machine learning, like advanced computing hardware, semiconductor manufacturing equipment, companies that specialize in the perception, collection, visualization, or management of big data. And you know, all of those names are essentially equal weighted in this ETF. And I mean, I'll just give you an example of some of them, like D-Wave, Rigetti, Palantir, you know, Intel, and of course the big ones like the Google, IBM, and Honeywell's that have been involved in this. But, and you know, what we do is we just try to create like a very broad exposure to this space, and it changes like as new quantum companies come out and they kind of meet the market cap requirements, it gets included in the index. You know, if companies are kind of no longer invested in this, they get removed from the index. But the idea is it's 40 basis points. It's an ETF, you know, over $1 billion in AUM now. It's been our fastest growing product, and it's got 73 holdings. And yeah, it's just really meant to represent, you know, quantum computing and machine learning and how these two things are basically transformative technologies we're shaping in the future.
Thank you so much, Sylvia. And where can people learn more about this directly?
You can go to our website, defianceetfs.com, or, you know, your brokerage firm will have information if you type in your ticker too.
Beautiful. Everybody, this will wrap up this iteration of the Quantum Computing panel. I want to thank Sylvia for not only sponsoring this panel by way of Quantum ETFs, QTUM, and as well for being here herself to lend her investment expertise and experience in this field. It's always really nice to have that factor on the panel, especially from that investment side of things. So thank you so much again, Sylvia.
Thank you so much, Nicholas, and thank you to everyone for giving me the opportunity to talk with you about this today. I appreciate it.
Thanks again to you, Sylvia. Thanks again to the panelists for being here, and of course, Defiance ETFs for making this panel possible. Have a great rest of your day, everybody.